Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. I'm your host, Eric Paul. In studio today, we are grateful to welcome in the dynamic force behind the new metal reggae band Island Asylum, Anthony. In this episode, Anthony takes us back to where music became a huge part of his life, to today where music is again a vital part of his lifeblood, as well as the corporate detour in between. Please enjoy. Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in musician, lyricist, and frontman, Anthony of Island Asylum. Anthony, welcome, man.
What up, man?
Good. I'm happy to have you here, dude. We've had Body here. We've had some of the rest of the crew here. I'm glad to get you in, man.
Right on. Happy to be here. Honored, man.
So I know that there's some people that are going to be familiar with what you're doing, and of course some that aren't. So let's kind of rewind it to where music comes into your life and start to frame this picture. Paint me what it looks like where music hits Anthony over the head.
Like when?
Yeah.
You mean? Oh, yeah. Boy. The womb, I guess.
Nice.
No, I probably the teenage years was when I really like it was like, okay, that's what I want to do. That's where I want to be. I want to be around live music as often as humanly possible. And it was... metal that really spoke to me at that time. Like when I was really young, you know, I got into like the cheesy rap, you know, the Vanilla Ice,
yeah.
MC Hammer,
nice,
and you know, that kind of stuff. But then when I hit the teenage years, it was like holy hell! Like I just wasn't. I didn't have access to metal. Like I wasn't really allowed to watch MTV and stuff like that, so when it hit really hard. It was like, whoa, what the hell is that? And you know, especially you know, age 12 13 14, when I started to get into like you know, the new metal stuff.
Right.
I feel like we're about the same age. I'm 38.
I'm 43.
Okay. So yeah, when I was 14, that's 1999. So, I mean, you know what was around.
Oh, yeah.
And coming through at that point. And I remember earlier than that when I was, so probably 96, so I was like 11. I remember one of the older kids on the bus, one of the cool kids, had his Discman.
Oh.
And he's like, you got to hear this. And that was the first time I heard Korn, and it was those dropped guitars. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
Right.
What is that? I'd never heard anything like that before.
No, at the time, that
heavy
was...
and that... you know, that low.
Right.
And after that, like, I kept seeking those guitars, and I couldn't find that sound anywhere else. And then a couple of years later, that sound was everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Other people were looking, too.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously the Slipknots, the System of a Downs, and the... all of that. And then I went back in time. You know, after I got my my first taste of metal with the new metal stuff, then it was like, all right, let's see, where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, I started getting into Sabbath and Metallica and all that.
So you didn't come up in like an overly musical household or anything like that?
Not at all. No, my household was Elvis Presley and like... Donna Summer and the Supremes and stuff like that.
So at least good vocal parents, references.
For sure. But that's what my parents listened to. And yeah, I wasn't allowed to listen to any of that stuff. I had to like sneak it.
So was your first exposure to that with no MTV, radio wasn't playing it really then at that point, was just other kids on the bus?
Other kids on the bus and when I would sneak it. Like I remember... I was at my grandmother's house, and that's where I would sneak a lot of MTV.
Nice.
And yeah, I remember that was like the first time I heard Nirvana, was sneaking it on my grandmother's couch. And what a moment that was.
I can't imagine that. It was such a pivotal time for everybody that was letting themselves be exposed to that stuff, yeah, or being hit by it.
And it just felt inherently cooler because I wasn't allowed to,
yes,
see it, and I was sneaking it.
Yeah, right. There was definitely some more of a danger element then.
Yeah.
For sure. We've lost a little bit of that, I guess.
And the I don't know if I'm allowed to mention this name anymore, but Marilyn Manson, like before any of the stuff that's going on now.
Right.
It was just like, oh man, like, was this guy sent here to scare the shit out of me? Like,
right.
It's working, but I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot, there's definitely, that's harder to come by now, I would say.
Yeah. It's all been done.
And, yeah.
You know, the folks that are, I don't know who that would be now. I guess like Sleep Token and Ghost and
or
stuff like that.
That guy in Slaughter to Prevail.
Yeah,
he's a bit scary.
But it's you know, K-Fob has been broken forever.
Right.
It's like, you know, I don't want to compare like eras, because you know everybody thinks that their generation is the best generation.
Yeah, right.
And all this
of
and
course.
That. But it's like, it's like the same time it happened with professional wrestling, it happened with music. It's like the cover's been blown off. Everyone knows, like,
yeah.
We live in a world now where like the guys from Slipknot, you see on their Instagram, they're at Disney World, and it's like,
it's, yeah,
the fuck is that? Like, but it's just different now.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody saw that one coming.
Yeah.
So how do you go from that first initial feeling of that, like, rebel blood feeling watching Nirvana at your grandma's house into performing and wanting to make your own music? What's the timeline in between those events like?
Not a whole lot of time. So I started like writing silly songs, when I was 10 years old.
That's, and you could play instruments then, or you were
just writing silly stuff with my friends. I had a karaoke machine.
Oh, nice.
That, you know, we would, you know, one of us would beatbox and the other one would like sing and rap these ridiculous stuff. And, I think I was 13 or 14 rather when I got my first guitar, tuned it right to drop D, one finger bandit.
There you go.
And
you could get a lot of mileage out of that, though.
I did. I still do.
Yeah.
Like I joke, but I'm not really joking. I never really got much better than when I was like 17 years old at guitar. I just kind of like, I kind of do the same stuff just a little differently.
Right. Yeah. Well.
But yeah, I got my first guitar when I was 14, and where I grew up, there wasn't really a whole lot to do. It was in the middle of the woods, farms, and me and my friend got a drum set, and like that's really all I did. It's all I cared about, was music and learning to play. I played my first live show when I was 15, I think.
Nice.
Yeah. Boy, was it awful. But, you know, I still wanted to do it after that. And I just never really stopped.
What was that first gig like? Just you and your boy playing drums?
No. We got my buddy to play guitar and another friend to play bass, and it was all original songs.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
That's rare.
It was funny. I think we had to lie about our age to play the gig, if I'm remembering correctly. It was like an 18 and up thing, and we had to lie to play it. And, you know, it was some open mic thing where you get 15 minutes in front of six people.
Right, yeah. But man, is it glorious.
Yeah, it sure was. And I just remember after that, I'm like, I want to do that again. I'm like, why? Like, that like really sucked if you think about it, but I want to do it again. It's something just hit me. And just kind of kept going. And ripped off every band that I liked and kept writing that way. And I, you know, still do that today.
So when you first start and you're just, you know, you got the high school band kicking, what's the next stage of that?
The next stage of that was, I was in and out of bands all throughout high school. And it was really like my first year of college where, you know, I got serious, I would say. That band wound up doing some cool stuff. You know, we got to open for a lot of nationals.
Nice.
We got in good with this promoter. And, you know, looking back, it's because we were gullible, you know, selling a shitload of your own tickets.
Right.
You know, making like, you know, $100 for selling 100 tickets.
Yeah, we were just talking about that yesterday. You're talking like the two drink minimum type deals?
No. We didn't do any of that, but it was like, okay, you could open up for this band, but you have to sell 100 tickets.
Okay.
So you know, all your family and friends, and, you know, you sold 100 tickets at $20 a pop and walk away with $100.
Right.
It was that kind of deal. You pay to play, basically.
Yeah. We were just talking about that with everybody. And where were you when this was going on? Not in Florida?
No, Long Island, New York. Okay. That's where I grew up. That's where I spent the first 30 years of my life before I moved to Florida.
Okay, so you're in college in New York as well?
Yes.
Okay. So college starts going, you're going around in these bands. Where does that lead you? Because that's usually, you start to be on the escalator up at that point, yeah?
Yeah, so that's when I was insanely into it. That was, like, in my mind, I forgot that there was a such thing as, like, a working class musician. I thought it was, you made it, or you didn't.
Mm.
I just didn't process it in any other way.
Right.
So what happened was after, you know, we had seen some success, I guess you would call it, not financially,
yeah,
in the slightest.
But you got some attention.
We had got some attention, and we got to play some really cool shows with some really cool bands, some of which are still, like, doing their thing now.
Nice.
I remember my first, like, oh shit moment was a band called Kitty. Mm-hmm. You remember them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I had their poster on my wall growing up. And then, what was it, 2008? We got to open for them and a band called In This Moment.
Nice.
They're still doing their thing.
Yeah.
And that to me was like, oh man, I made it. Going on like 3 hours before them, bunch of locals. But to me, it was like, we did it.
Yeah, you know? We're here.
We sold 100 tickets, made $100.
Yeah.
And, but it was such a huge deal. But so what wound up happening is we were going for this Jägermeister, sponsorship. I remember vividly. And we were in like one of the final rounds for it. And my drummer wound up getting locked up.
Oh.
And like right before the gig, I was supposed to go pick him up. And I call him, he's not picking up. I'm like, oh boy. So finally I call him and someone picks up, but it's not him.
Oh.
And the guy like chuckles. And he's like, yeah, he's not gonna make it tonight. And hangs up on me. What the fuck? So I drive by his house, knock on the door, no one's there. I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
Right.
Finally, one of his buddies gets in touch with me that he got locked up, and the person that answered the phone was a cop. Saying, yeah, he's not going to make it tonight.
Yeah.
So, I went down to the precinct, and I'm like pleading with the people. I'm like, can't you just take him out in cuffs and bring him to the show and like
just leave him on a leash?
He'll play in cuffs, and we could, you know, you could take him right back. And you know, they laughed at me, and that was like the, not the final blow, but basically the final blow where I was like, man, fuck this. I wound up getting out of music and went into corporate America, did that for a bunch of years. And
so how long were you doing the band thing before that?
Before that,
you hit the point.
Yeah. Where that specific band was probably 4 years.
Okay.
but yeah, I'd, you know, been in bands since I was a kid.
Right.
But that band was like a good 4-year run. And that was the only band that I would consider like a real band that I was in, but yeah, that
so after
happening,
4 years of the slog.
Yeah. After, you know, doing the Weekend Warrior stuff, you know, touring, and playing, we played a lot of shows in Manhattan. We were like 2 hours east of Manhattan. We weren't anywhere close to anything. So every time we played a gig, we were driving an hour at least.
Dang.
But yeah, that was like, I was like, I gotta, in my mind and the way I grew up, unfortunately, it was like music is not a thing you can do for money. It wasn't. I would have gotten killed. Like, I would have gotten thrown out, probably. Like, if I had continued to, you know, try to go down that route, it was like, no, it's time to be a grown up. And
so you're like early 20s at this point?
Yeah. I was like 23. And I wound up getting into corporate America right after that, you know, after college ended. And I basically stopped music altogether.
Were you going to college for music?
No, I was going to college for business. College for music was not an option. I basically stopped music for like 10 years.
Damn.
Almost longer than that, probably. Because I started this project. I started toying with the idea of this project in like 2018, 2019. So that entire span was just me hating myself.
Yeah, I don't mean to poke the bear, but what were you doing in corporate America? How did you shift gears that hard and for that long?
Yeah, I started working for AT&T and, you know, slinging Blackberries.
Nice.
If that's not aging myself, I don't know what is. But yeah, slinging Blackberries to businesses, basically. And you know, worked there for a few years, had a couple other super corporate gigs, and, you know, until I found where I work now, which is a lot less corporate, still sales, but, you know, a lot more flexible, a lot cooler, a lot more work-life balance.
Important.
So unfortunately, yeah, for a long time, it was just like, yeah, I'll go to shows, but music just was basically out of the picture.
Wow.
And it fucking killed me.
So what was it like when you started to realize yourself, I got to get this back in the picture? What was the first time you started feeling like, oh man, maybe I can't just have music totally out of my life?
I think it was just, I'm like, yo, I feel dead. I feel dead inside. I'm not I don't love this. I don't love my life. I don't love what I'm doing. And I'm like, why? Why did I stop? Like, I still to this day, I'm like, why? Why did I stop? I don't know. Like, it was just, okay, I guess this part is over. You can't make money doing it, so don't do it.
Right.
Which is so stupid.
Right.
But
that's an instinct a lot of people have.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to pursue creative endeavor because that's just the reality of it.
Yeah. And then before I knew it, it was like, oh, I have a mortgage, so I can't do music.
Mm.
Got a car payment, can't do music, got, you know, and I just kept talking myself out of it, basically. I'm like, this is just going to cost you money and eat your time when you could be working.
Right.
Bad news.
So were you in Florida when that shift happens?
Yes. Yeah. I got to Florida in the summer of 2016. So it was the summer of 2018, 2019 when I started writing for this project.
What brought you here?
Asylum. The weather, and I finally got the ability to work from home.
Ah.
And like the second that happened, I put the house up for sale. It sold like 4 days later.
Nice.
And I was out of there. Yeah, I was like, I don't care if I ever see snow again.
That's what I was just gonna say. No more winter.
Yeah, basically. So that was what got me here.
So then you come down here, but then you didn't start making music right away when you first got here, yeah?
No, not for a couple of years.
So then, what was the impetus that brings Island Asylum into the world?
Okay. So I started seeing parallels between this American reggae stuff and nu metal. As weird as that sounds.
Not to me.
Okay.
So, I may be one of the few people that doesn't sound weird to, but not to me.
So I started to see, like, you know, I guess I don't know if you'd call them the OGs of the American reggae scene, but the folks that I thought were doing it really well were, you know, Stick Figure, Slightly Stupid, and a handful of others. And then I saw, so like, you remember when nu metal first happened and there was a handful of really good bands that were doing it, and you know, like 90% of the genre was really awful.
That didn't take long.
Kind of a joke. Man, this might piss some people off, but that's what I saw with the American reggae scene as well. I'm like, okay, there's the core group of folks that are doing it really well, and there's a soul behind it. And I don't know what went off in my mind. I think I was at one of the reggae rise ups, and I kind of was walking around. I'm like, these motherfuckers will listen to anything. And I know it's messed up to say, but
yeah,
I was like, but it was those couple of groups, and that I was like, wow, I actually feel something. Like, this is weird. This is reggae. I don't know reggae. I didn't, you know, my story into reggae is the same as everybody else's, you know, like, oh, I heard Sublime, and, you know, when I was little, I just thought Bob Marley was reggae, and that was right. The only reggae, and then I heard Sublime, and, you know, I realized you could mix in other genres, and, but yeah, it was one of the reggae rise-ups. I was like, huh, they're missing a crazy element here. I was like, what if I could be the crazy guy at the reggae shows? What if there's room for like a reggae Rob Zombie? Like, this is probably really stupid, but I'm gonna do it anyway. And
good instinct.
Yeah, I started writing for the project almost as a joke, I swear to God. Like, I was writing these really silly songs, and somewhere along the line I was like, I don't want this to be a joke. I don't like doing that. And there's some of those silly songs are on the record, on the first record. But after writing a few of those, I accidentally wrote some serious ones, and I'm like, ah, shit. All right, let me do that more. And I started taking it probably a little too seriously. And I started working with one of my producers, Kurt, who's really into like roots reggae. So I'm like, okay, I don't have to know everything about reggae, but let me surround myself with people who do. So I made it a point to, like, I got the metal part covered. Like, if I'm gonna do reggae metal, like, I got the metal part covered, but let me find, you know, the best people I can work with that know reggae, or at least American reggae.
Right.
So I started working with Kurt, and I reached out to, it was Zeb from Tribal Seeds
yeah.
at first, and I had all my drums programmed in at that point, but they were my drum ideas, which were not good. I'm not a drummer.
Right.
And so he took my song ideas and laid down real drums.
And when was this?
This was 2019.
So pretty soon after starting, pretty soon after writing.
20. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty soon I realized, like, I thought I was going to do everything, cause I saw Stick Figure doing everything, like playing all the instruments by himself. And that's what I wanted to do. Cause I'm like, oh, cool. Like, I don't have to work with other people.
Right.
And I quickly realized, like, no, this is going to suck if you do it that way.
Well, so, at least you realized it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, sorry.
No, you're good.
So I started, I sent Zeb all these horrible song ideas, mixed it in with a few good ones. Because in my mind, I'm like, I'm not going to get the chance to work with someone like that again. So let me send him everything just in case.
And how did you get that chance?
Believe it or not, like, I talk a lot of shit about social media, but it was totally social media that opened that door.
Cool.
And then, he kind of changed the course of Island Asylum because, again, it was just programmed drums. And once he laid real drums down, I'm like, okay, now let me get, I'm not a real bass player. Like, I fuck around, but I'm not a real bass player. I'm not a real guitar player, So I started to, okay, let me replace everything I've done now with real instruments, with people who know what the fuck they're doing.
Right.
So I did that, and I wound up working with Kevin Officer from Stick Figure. He started laying down drums for me. And eventually I met Blaine, who plays... he's on a lot of the songs as guitar and bass. He's actually a phenomenal bass player, even though, like, he's a guitarist by trade.
Right. And how'd you hook up with him? How'd you hook up with them?
Social media, again. I wound up just catching his podcast that he does, Coffee with Blaine, like, randomly a few times. And something just sparked, like, I don't know, like, I'm going to have chemistry with this guy.
So you just straight cold reached out to him?
Yeah, I just reached out to him, and I remember getting the first song back. I'm like, this motherfucker, this is it.
Nice.
And he's been on almost every song since then.
Very cool.
Because I can't play lead. I could write some bad solos. and some of my solos made the record, but he replayed them. And what he does is sometimes he'll play what I played, and sometimes he'll just come up with something so off the wall different. And I'm like, okay, that's why I did this. That's why I did this. I would not have thought of any of that shit. So, basically it was the not so harsh, but kind of like the harsh realization of, dude, you're not getting this done on your own.
Yeah.
Stop it.
There is some magic to collaboration.
Yeah, for sure.
So what was it like when you start getting these tracks back and all the music has been replaced and now it's your vocals over your ideas way more polished? What did that feel like?
The first thing was like the ego. It was like, get rid of that. Like, this is so clearly better. Like, don't even trip for a second on, you know, I want to be the one to play everything on the record. I want to do everything. It's like, immediately I was like, no, like, this is, there's a song called Never Let It Go. And that was one of the first songs I got back from Blaine. And there's a lyric in the song that goes, and it feels like, and then there's a guitar solo. And it was like that motherfucker reached into my heart and played the notes that I couldn't play. And I was like, okay, this is going to work. This is going to work long term. He's been on a bunch of the tracks. Zeb's on a bunch of the tracks. Kevin's on a bunch of the tracks. And my boy Kurt helped me produce a lot of the track. He mixes most of the songs. So that's that was it, basically. So
then at that point, though, we're starting to be on the doorstep of COVID, though, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. We were in it. We were in it by the time I reached out to Blaine.
Okay.
I think Zeb was like either just pre-COVID or at the very beginnings of it. But COVID sparked a lot of this project. It was kind of the shakeup that I needed. Like, all right, dude, are you going to do this or not? Like, the world fucking stopped for you. Do it. The whole world stopped. Are you going to do something or not?
Ah.
And very thankful that I decided to do it. And you know, I always go back and forth because I hate everything after writing the song, basically.
What do you mean?
I don't know. The release, the I'm not so great with marketing myself. I feel like I could talk all day about everyone else, but I just feel silly talking about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like once the song is done, I hate it. By the time the song is done, I've heard it so many times and tweaked it so many ways that it's like, all right, let me just release it. Otherwise, it's never going to see the light of day.
Right.
And then it's like, I don't know. It's this stupid thing that I go through.
Do you think some of that comes from coming or having the reference to the late 90s, early 2000s, when everything wasn't necessarily this clout grab? I mean, when we had bands like Slipknot that deliberately didn't want you to know who they were.
Yes. Yeah, because you can't do that anymore.
Right. You can't even attempt that in attempts to be cool anymore.
No, because it's not, yeah, it's you just can't. So, yeah, all of my idols, I guess you'd call them, were like these dark, mysterious personalities, and now it's like, hey, I'm fucking brushing my teeth.
Right.
What's up, everybody? Like, what the fuck are we doing? But it's adapt to it or get left behind.
Right.
So, like, this next release, I'm making sure, like, I think in a lot of ways I fucked up the first release, straight up. Like, I again, by the time it came out, I hated all the songs. I didn't want to see myself on camera. I still don't really like it.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing for the next release is I'm making sure that before anyone hears a single note, I have all the videos planned out, all the socials planned out, and I'm putting it on a scheduler. Last time around, I had the intent. I had good intentions to, you know, post every day, you know, but I would wake up and I'd be like, I'm not fucking posting that. I hate that. I don't like it anymore. I'm not doing that.
Right.
And then I would get into the dangerous mindset of who gives a shit? Why am I going to, no one gives a shit about me. No one gives a shit about like, so I'm just going to stay away from it. And it's a great way to go nowhere.
Right.
So next time around, everything is going to be on a scheduler. So it's like hands off.
And you don't get that hamster wheel feeling.
Yeah, I can't like the posts are going to happen no matter how I'm feeling that day.
There
and
you go.
And I could hop on and just respond to the comments, you know, if there are any, and go that route.
So what was it like then in the road between starting this first album when COVID's hitting the door and releasing it? What was different then? Because you weren't playing shows, right? Obviously, no one was. So how did you handle putting that first one out that you're going to do differently now?
Not well. I didn't handle it very well.
Did you do like the put out a whole bunch of singles and then the record?
Yeah, and I did not like that either. Like, you know, back in my day, you know, you got a couple of singles and then you drop the record, right?
Right.
And that's what I wanted to do, and I quickly realized like that's like shouting in an empty room.
It's so sad, but I ask everybody how they feel about that because I find that so strange. I mean, or I shouldn't say I find it very strange because it's totally common now. I just find that to be such a drastic change.
I despise it. I hate it with every fiber of my being, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
Like, yeah, it's really that there's just no choice anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I liken it to like if you went to see a movie and you had seen half of it already, would the movie be as exciting? Well, of course not. But if you say that about a record, people are like, nah, I still want to hear the singles first.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the next go around, I'm going to basically do a single a month, a single every 6 weeks. And, you know, you could hear how excited I am about that in my voice. But it's just the way you got to do it in order to gain any traction, I feel like.
Yeah.
So the difference between the first record and this one, obviously, I'm going to release it differently. But the music's also a lot different. This release is a lot darker. It's a lot heavier. The first release was kind of like the experiment.
Right.
It was like, let me try a song like this. Let me try. The album feels more like a compilation than an album because there's a lot of different styles, and it was a lot of just me trying shit. Blaine actually helped me realize, like, no, like, you're new metal reggae. You're new metal reggae. And he kept on saying that. And when he would introduce me to people, he'd be like, this is Anthony. He's got a really cool new metal reggae project. And I'm like, well, that wasn't the intent. But fuck, he's right. So the next release is very new metal reggae.
Nice.
Yeah.
And are you going to put physical copies out?
Probably not.
I know.
I'll go back in time and do that if there's a demand for it at some point.
How do you feel about not making physical albums anymore? The experience for the consumer end of it.
So, yeah. I
do you remember the first album you bought?
Yes.
What was it?
311 Blue Album.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So
that was my first CD, I should say.
I had
a bunch of tapes before that. But that was my first CD, and I'll never forget the feeling of opening it up, looking at I think there was lyrics on that album, if I'm not mistaken,
in the liner notes.
In the booklet.
Yeah, yep. And the CD was like the sun or like a ball of fire or whatever. The disc itself.
No, the Blue Album. Oh. Yes. Yeah, the Blue Album was the Ball of Fire disc.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that one changed my life too. So I remember the first time I heard Guns Are for Pussies, I was like, there we go. That's my jam right there.
Yeah, I was, 10 years old when that record came out, and probably 11 when I bought it.
Damn.
And I was lucky enough to have a friend that was my age but had an older sister. And we listened to that album on repeat in his basement, and he taped it for me on a cassette.
Hell yeah.
For Christmas. And I remember I was playing it in my dad's work van, and we got to a certain point, and he heard a curse word, and he was like, nope. that's the end of that. But yeah, that was my first album. And to answer your question, sorry, this is very long-winded.
No.
But to answer your question, I hate it and I love it. I hate it and I love it. Not having to have the physical copies. Like, I came from giving out my demo on a CD,
right?
You know, out of the trunk of our cars. So I miss it, but I love the fact that, it's so accessible now.
Like, mm-hmm.
You just go on, you know, DistroKid or whoever you're using, and you have a song out. And, you couldn't do that. Back in our day.
There's a lot more legwork, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, like I remember in that first band that I told you about, like, me and my bass player took the train into Manhattan, and we snuck into the Roadrunner building.
Damn.
Like, that was, like, in my silly brain, that was how you had to be discovered by a record label. And so we snuck into the building and made our way up to the Roadrunner floor by basically hanging out in the elevator and waiting for someone to hit that floor. I looked up what floor they were on, because we did have internet. And we waited for someone to go to that floor, and we just followed them out, and we got caught. And, you know, we had our press package that had, like, our photos and our demo CD in it. And I was like, before we get kicked out of here, can I just use the bathroom? And, we left it behind in the bathroom, and I wrote, like, do not throw out on it. And, wouldn't you know it, I never heard from Roadrunner.
Someone didn't follow directions.
So, yeah, things are so different now. It's like, record labels are almost like a detriment. They're seen as like a detriment now. Everything is independent. Everybody's
right.
An indie now, which I think is beautiful in a way. But it's also, it also kind of deepens the void in a way.
Yeah. You know,
what's it like, 200,000 songs a day are uploaded to Spotify?
Something like that, yeah.
It's just as hard to be seen now as back then. It's just, you know, there's different vehicles, but it's, you know, I don't think it's any harder or less hard.
Do you regret or have any feeling towards the fact that someone isn't going to have their first Island Asylum experience like you had your first 311 experience?
No, because I'll just be happy if someone has an Island Asylum experience, period.
Yeah, and the streaming inherently makes that easier.
Yes. So that's always a really cool thing. You know, it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's like, oh, you found me? Like,
right.
That's fucking dope. Like, you found my music through a thing that I did. Like, I threw up a thing on the internet and you saw it and you liked it. That's, I don't care that it's not physical media.
Have you noticed anything like that in any of your analytics? Like, you got people in the Philippines listening to your music, or Germany or whatever listening to your music?
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that when I see that, I always think, you know, this is a thing that back in my day would have never happened.
Yeah,
you know
that
what I
blows
mean?
My mind. That, you know, we don't have a ton of listeners yet, but whenever I see someone like in Turkey listening to our music or anywhere other than the US, it's like, how the fuck did that happen?
No shit.
That's really cool.
I wonder what that scene must be like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So when are you going to release this next record? Are you done with it? Are you midstream with it? How you with this one?
It's, the writing is done. The pre-production is done. All the instruments are laid down. It just needs to be mixed. And, okay, that's not totally true. I'm waiting on a couple of vocal features to come back.
That's always the last hurdle, the features.
Yeah, yeah. And that's also something that is completely different now versus back when we came up.
Yeah?
I think so. Yeah.
Now, oh, just the ubiquitousness of having a feature.
Yeah,
yeah, like, you pretty much have to.
Yeah, it's wild. Like, when we came up, it was like the features were like almost earth shattering every
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, Anthrax with Public Enemy. What the fuck?
Right.
It was.
God, you know, I lived on that when I was a kid.
For us, it was, you know, Korn and Ice Cube.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yes.
And now we're being taught by the powers that be to basically find other people like you and have them be a feature. Find the artists that have higher streaming numbers than you, but are in the same kind of soundscape and same genre. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. I think, like, why am I going to have a feature that sounds like me? What the fuck's the point?
Right. That's an interesting observation.
So Island Asylum's inherently a bit different, so it's easier for me to find people that aren't like me.
Purposeful to some degree, I imagine.
Yeah, 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 of course. But it's just weird now. Like, every album has a shitload of features. And I'm like, why? Why? Is there an artistic reason? Or are you doing it to get the streaming numbers?
Yeah, this is a cloud sharing thing.
You're collabing because, okay, now your song will show up on their Spotify.
Right.
It's like, that's the reason we're doing this.
Yeah.
Fuck. All right, I guess I got to do it too. But it's weird. So again, long-winded to answer your question, it's almost done.
And how many tracks are you going to have on this one?
So the way I'm doing this one is it's going to be an EP with 7 or 8 tracks. And then I have a bunch of singles that are just like, don't make any sense with the EP.
Okay.
So I'll release them haphazardly, you know, as just singles.
And this is sort of to avoid that, having another record that sounds like a comp thing?
Yes. Very much so.
Okay. So I'm guessing that the tongue-in-cheek songs or whatever, the goofy stuff that you started in the beginning, that's what's kind of been left along the side of the road as you've gone along.
No, I'm doing those as the singles.
Ah, okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
So when I started, this was totally a silly goose project.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is where I could just be silly and the songs will be silly. And when I started to get more serious, it was like, what the fuck is this project? And I realized it has to be both. It has to be both Silly Goose and serious. So that's why, you know, there will be songs about the darkness, my life, and then there'll be, you know, dick joke songs. I have to have both sides. Otherwise, like, I'll get too serious and it won't be fun.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that either.
Because was that sort of the mentality that kind of dirt roaded your first round of music?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So that was a good way to get your toe back in the music water, was not have to be so fucking serious right out of the gate.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, let me, because I won't care how it turns out as much. Like, I won't care if people dig it as much if it's silly anyway.
Yeah.
But if it's like soul crushing shit and I'm throwing it out there, it kind of sucks when it doesn't land.
Yeah, right. Then you're in that shouting in an empty room scenario.
Yeah.
Right. So what are you most looking forward to with this next drop? Are you going to be playing a lot more shows, or what's the big excitement now with round two coming out more purposeful like this?
So yes, I want to play more shows, but I want to play shows with a purpose. I want there to be somewhat of a demand. Like I did the playing to 15 people, you know, every weekend. Like I did that shit early on. Mm-hmm. And it sucks. It's not to say I wouldn't do it again. No, it is. I won't do it again. I want to play more shows, but I need to build a demand. I need to build a demand for the shows before I go out there. And like, I can't do it. I can't do the, you know, five nights a week in front of six people. Like, what? There's no purpose. There needs to be a purpose. So build the demand. That's what this is for. Build the demand through online content.
So how do you handle your live shows? Because the core of everything is you, and Blaine is your main collaborator, yeah?
Blaine and Kurt, yeah.
Okay, so, but do they play with you live?
I've only done one live show under this moniker.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, there's only been one Island Asylum show so far.
Okay, so you kind of get to set the standard now with this. Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. So how do you ideally see doing that? Do you want to put together like straight rock band style and reggae it up, or you got to try to find reggae musicians and rock them up?
Yes. Totally both.
Because you are kind of looking for a somewhat narrow lane or unique skill set.
I think it's easier for me to find metal people. And
yeah,
that's just my language. That's what I speak. So,
right.
I don't know. See, I'm a fan of fish out of water, like Bada on bass, mm-hmm. you know, playing metal songs with me. That's a fish out of water, but I like that.
Yeah. He seems to really like it too.
Good. Yeah.
I mean, he was enthusiastic when we were talking about it.
I think he's enjoying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, the guy from Hyrie playing these super heavy songs. Like, I like that. So it's not necessarily getting the reggae people and metaling them up, or the metal people and reggaeing them up. It's about finding cool people that I could hang out with for a long period of time. I think it was Morgan from Seven Dust. Mm-hmm. He said, if you could find people that are cool, and let's say they play at a level 6 or a 7 out of 10 versus like people that are not so cool, but they play at a level 11, he's like, I'll choose the 6s and 7s all day.
Right.
He's like, and that's how you build a band. Not to say that any of the people I fuck with aren't 10s, but it's they got to be cool.
It's more that there's a value in who they are as people, not just what they can do as musicians.
Yeah, exactly. Like I want from day one, I'm like, this needs to be a band. Like, that's kind of another thing about, you know, this era, so to speak, and I feel like an old man again, but I feel like there's no real bands anymore. It's like, okay, there's a singer-songwriter and his hired guns.
Right.
I'm like, I'm fucking sick of that shit.
Right.
The thing about bands is everyone has their member that they gravitate towards, so I want to find my polar opposite in a lot of these members. Maybe one or two guys that are dark like me, but I want my polar opposite up there next to me. I liken it to, I go back to professional wrestling. Like, what's the Ultimate Warrior without the Undertaker?
Right.
So I need to find my Hulk Hogans and my Ultimate Warriors, you know, for my Undertaker.
Right. That's how the dynamic will be more, contrast, more yes. prevalent.
Split the house.
Yeah. There you,
know,
you go.
Split the house. And, you know, if half the people like, you know, the dark aspect and half the people are there for good vibes only or whatever the fuck, that's cool. That's what I want.
How do you manage that though? I mean, for you personally, when you're writing, do the thoughts cross your mind? It's like, hey, I'm writing something, you know, relatively, I can just say not necessarily dark, but just not good vibes only. Do you worry that, or I shouldn't say, do you worry, but does it cross your mind that, oh shit, this might alienate half of the people that would like my music? And then when you write something maybe too silly goosey, you're like, oh shit, this might alienate half my audience. Or does that, those thoughts never even enter your mind?
The thoughts enter my mind and then I say, fuck them.
Good tactic.
Yeah. It's whatever it is. I am dark and serious and I'm very silly. So whatever happens, you know, but it does play a role in how I'm releasing. So I'm keeping the songs that sound like they belong together, versus the silly stuff. The silly stuff's just more marketable. It's easier. It's not necessarily easier to write the silly stuff, but it's easier to market and it's easier to, it has more of a broad appeal.
Why do you think that is? Because, I mean, I know heavy music has got incredibly loyal fans, but we're not talking about loyal, we're talking about broad.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's easier to market silly than it is to market serious to a degree. I just think it just inherently has more of a broad appeal. I don't know.
Was it really relieving for you to get into something where you, like I said, when you started this again, to have your toe in the silly water first? I
yes.
mean, was that just?
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to make sure. And even the first, I remember the first song that I worked on with Kurt was a song that didn't even make the record. And I kind of knew it wasn't going to make the record. I was like, let me start with something I don't give a shit about just in case it doesn't work out. Like, it was kind of like a safety net almost. Like, let me start with this silly stuff that's, you know, it has no emotional bearing. It's just, let's see how it goes.
Let's just exercise the muscle for the sake of
exactly.
it. Exactly. Not try to win the Super Bowl.
Getting back into it was scary.
Right.
To a degree. It was like, let me just throw some shit against the wall and muscle memory, like you said. Let's hop back up on the bike and see what we can do.
So are you a believer or a practicer in you have to write bad songs to write good songs?
No. Not necessarily. I don't write a lot of songs. I know people that write 30 songs for a record, you know,
right.
and take the best 10.
Right.
I don't really do that. I'll maybe write 15 to get to 10.
And you've always done that?
Yeah. It's like once I know, I have a shitload of ideas, don't get me wrong. But once I take it past a certain point, it's like, no, I know I'm going to finish that one.
Okay.
Yeah, so I won't finish 30 songs to whittle it down to 15. I just can't operate that way.
Okay.
It's let me take what I just know. I just know, like, I'm going to take this to the finish line.
That's a good thing to know. You don't waste your time chasing down a bunch of trails with nothing on them.
Yeah. Also, I think it's an efficiency issue. Like, I know people that could bang out songs super quick, and I'm just not one of those people.
So do you write kind of in fits and starts, like a bunch here and then nothing, or is it just kind of like a steady stream for you? What is your writing process like if you don't just crap out a ton of stuff and whittle it down?
It's a whole lot of, it's insane, everything, and then it's nothing. It's, I'm in writing mode,
mm-hmm.
and that's all I do. I'm obsessed with it. I'm crazy about it. I'm replaying everything, and it consumes my life. And then it's kind of like drugs almost, where it's like this is everything, and then it's like this disgusts me. Get it the fuck away from me,
right?
And then I go back to it.
Yeah, right. And that's the magic of it, right there.
Yeah.
Right? So right now you're at a stage though where we're loving it. We're not.
Yeah, right now I'm pretty hyped about what's coming out next.
When, do you have a date that you think you're going to try to have the EP out by? Or are you going to start releasing singles by? Are you giving yourself a little bit open-ended time frame yet?
I can't do it that way. I can't do it with a date.
No deadlines?
No deadlines. It's got to... I have to be done with everything. That's the other part. It's not just the music. I could be done with the music, but I need to get all these fucking videos ready to go. I need to get, my 15-second clips every day. I need to make sure everything's ready to go this time before I hit the go button. Because once I hit the go button, that's it.
Right. That puts you on the hamster wheel, but not necessarily having to ride it, just
exactly
sitting there letting it go.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be also probably a relieving thing, I suppose. So are you going to try to start writing the next round right away after that, given that you're going to have some space with some of the marketing being automated? Or are you going to try to get the band together and start playing live sooner than later? Is it write more or play more after this?
Write more. Definitely write more. And see, the other thing is when I get caught up in releasing, I can't write. It's like I'm very one-dimensional. Like I'm all in on something and nothing else matters.
Mm.
That fucked me up this first go, because once I started releasing stuff, it was like, okay, I got to concentrate on the release, and I stopped writing.
Ah.
So that I really want to change this time around. Since the release is going to be automated, so to speak, I feel like that'll free me up. Like, I'm not really releasing. All I did was hit a button.
Yes.
So now I could write.
So you won't have to have the mental real estate being taken up by daily bullshit. So you can put that mental real estate towards writing more.
Exactly.
Smart. Cool. So you think you're going to put out two records next year then?
No. It'll be one EP and a bunch of singles.
Okay. Well, let's get you out of here on something fun and easy then, not deadlines and,
sure.
and where you're going to be in 5 years talk. If you could put Island Asylum on a bill, you and two other bands, what's your dream bill? And let's just say it's your CD release party for this one. If you could drop this CD to the world with your two favorite bands or two most complimentary bands with you, who would it be?
Oh, geez. How silly can we get with it? Like how?
You can. There's no rules. There's no lines, however you want to answer.
So completely not realistic then?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You're in charge.
Yeah. So I'll take, give me Black Sabbath from the 70s. And,
no shit.
And opening for Island Asylum.
Yeah. We've gone Twilight Zone.
Yeah, it'll be Black Sabbath opening and then Slipknot direct support. An Island Asylum headline.
There you go. That might be our biggest juxtaposition answer we've had. I dig
it's
that
so
one.
So dumb, but it's, yeah.
Well, dude, if that show happens, I'm there. When the time machines are going and they bring everybody back, I'm there. When Joey and Paul are back and everybody from Sabbath, I'm there. Well, Anthony, I got to tell you, I had a blast hearing from you, man. Thank you so much for coming down, and we're definitely going to do this again, and I can't wait to hear this new music, brother.
Who edits this? Okay, I'm sorry, man. I pause like a motherfucker.
No, that's all right. He gets paid the big bucks.
All right, good.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no shit, man.